Hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast, hosted by me, Sam Harris. A person with a growth mindset believes that their most basic abilities can be developed through dedication and hard work. Brains and talent are just the starting point. This view creates a love of learning and a resilience that is essential for great accomplishment. On the podcast, I find incredible individuals doing things I'd like to be great at. I break down their approach and insights to show how people can go about achieving their dreams. My guest is Dean Hume, the CTO of Settled, a rapidly growing property tech startup in London that helps streamline and simplify the process of buying and selling a house. It's a great business tackling a big problem. Dean is also the author of three books relating to software development and building teams. He's a very genuine guy who tells it as it is and has the nicest smile you will ever see. Sadly, this is just audio, but I hope you get to feel his warmth come through your speakers. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Lovely to have you. First question is, who are you? How would you introduce yourself?
So my name's Dean Hume. I like long walks on the beach, red wine, and puppy dogs. No, I'm joking.
Perfect date.
If I'm at a dinner party and if I'm introducing myself, I just say, hey, my name's Dean. I don't really go into my day job that much. Sometimes people ask you and they say, oh, you know, so what do you do for a living? And I'll say, oh, you know, I'm a software developer. Okay. And I don't really go much further than that. Sometimes I even just stop at programmer and leave it there. So, yeah. But if it's talking to work colleagues or, you know, business partners, I guess it's really just talk about being the CTO at Settled and talk about some of the stuff we do. So, yeah.
People kind of get a bit sort of impressed when you're like CTO, or do you try to just not mention it unless someone already knows kind of who you work for and what you're doing?
Yeah, exactly. I'd say that's probably spot on. I mean, CTOs can be taken in such different contexts. I mean, you know, you get someone like the CTO of IBM, and that's huge, obviously. And then, yeah. You know, startup CTOs, I guess, play a bit of a different role. Kind of a jack of all trades, a little bit part-time coder, part-time scrum master, part-time project manager.
Okay, so what's your background? Like, where are you from? Like, how did you get to here?
So, what is my background? I was originally born in South Africa, hence the slightly weird accent.
Yeah, wasn't it it's like, not England, but maybe Australia, maybe South Africa?
Yeah, I've been living in the UK, well, in London for 10 years, really. So, I've kind of got this weird hybrid accent that's not quite South African, but not quite English. And it confuses people a lot.
Yeah.
But yeah, so, you know, I was born in South Africa. I grew up I spent most of my time in a town called Durban, which is on the East Coast. And it's this laid back sort of surfer town. You know, it's a great place to grow up. The weather's fantastic. The water's like sunny and warm all the time.
And now you're in London? What went wrong?
It's funny. I mean, I came over, you know, just for 6 months to explore London and see what it's about and travel a bit. Mm. And 6 months turned into 6 years, and it's 10 years now. And, you know, I love it here. It's great. Yeah. So much going on. I love the buzz of the city. It's really fun. Mm.
So what did you study? Like, how did you get into being a CTO?
I didn't actually study. So I went to college. I didn't actually go to university. So I studied programming. It ended up being like 2 and a bit year course anyway. It was a very practical, hands-on thing. So, you know, we were almost coding immediately. And it missed out a big part of what I thought was, you know, the theory of coding. And while it was great to kind of give you a head start, you know, to get straight into a career, one of the things that I felt that I've had to almost teach myself as time has gone on is the real theory behind, you know, talking about algorithms and talking about, you know, like why data structures and why certain things are done a certain way. The problems that come at scale, if you want to think about it that way, you know, why certain structures apply in certain ways. And I've been, you know, trying to learn more about that as time has gone on. And I kind of, in a weird way, I kind of wish I did go to uni to learn all these things.
But I've definitely missed all of these things by doing a boot camp. I've started reading a book like Structure and Interpretation of Programming.
Yeah.
CP, of computer programs, I think. Just like how do you actually sort of build it from the core of how do you make stuff scalable and things. And it's quite interesting and like just really useful for if you want to do something bigger, which I haven't really been taught how to do it all.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is handy. But so how did you then go from teaching? So you were on a program to learn software development?
And
then
you just got jobs. So I straight after that, I ended up in South Africa, in Durban. I ended up working for a company. They did home loans and basically I spent most of my time kind of what coined a term called the support developer, basically like fixing bugs as they came in from like the B2B side of things. And yeah, from there, I just really loved everything to do with computers, coding, developing. And over time, you know, moved more into full-time development and then eventually found that I really enjoyed working with people and the team side of things and making sure that, you know, how projects were run and, you know, tracking where they came in. And it's been weird. It's almost like stumbled into it. Some of the things that make this world, you know, so exciting is having a passion for what you do. You can go anywhere in tech. There's, you know, you can go down, learn about networking, you can learn about AI, you can it's huge. The possibilities are endless. And it's a really exciting career.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited. Is there anything, if you weren't doing tech, that you'd also like to be doing?
Oh, that's a good question. It's weird. I think when I was a kid, I always wanted to be in the army. I wanted to be in the SAS. That was like the dream.
I thought you were going to say astronaut then.
No. And then, you know, I kind of grew up and I was like, yeah, that looks like too much hard work. Mm. If I was good enough, I would love to be a professional triathlete.
Yeah?
Yeah, I do a bit of triathlon on the side and I suck. Yeah. But it's fun. I'm not that good. I really enjoy it, but I'd love to be good enough to be a professional or just get paid to just wake up and train all day long. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's like a nice lifestyle. Yeah. Definitely, you just get to eat so much and
exactly. See all these nice places. Be outside in the weather. When the weather's good, but yeah.
It's perfect. So these are just like normal length triathlons or like ever done any ultra?
Yeah, I mean, I've kind of done mixed lengths. I've done everything from sprint to Olympic and then most recently last year I did a half Ironman. Which is pretty cool. I don't think I'll ever go further than that. It's crazy stuff.
Yeah, I kind of worry about like my joints and things and I get to like serious distances. It wasn't that healthy. But I'd like to test my body doing it.
Yeah.
But I just don't know if I'd ever then be able to like walk again. That's just a bit of a problem. So do you have like other people that you do that with or you just train by yourself?
I have some. I have one friend that's kind of into triathlons. I don't have a lot of friends that are into like all of them. I have some mates that I go cycling with or I have some mates that I go running with. So kind of make up the Lego block that is triathlon.
Does that sort of fit into your work schedule? Like you just get up at like 6 a.m. and go training or like?
Yes. Sometimes I'd go for a swim early in the morning. You know, when I was training up for the Ironman, I'd go for a swim first thing in the morning. But now at the moment, when the weather's this good, we've actually just started a run club at Settles. And we go for a lunchtime run just along. I mean, it's beautiful. You know, we're based situated in Hoxton, so we go for runs along the canal and soak in the weather. So it's great.
Perfect.
You should join in. We need more in the team.
Yeah. I've been just going to the gym by myself for lunches.
Yeah. That's good.
That's awesome. Cool. So yeah, you mentioned Settle. That's your current project then. So can you tell me more about that? So you're the CTO?
Yeah.
You're not the original CTO though?
I'm not the original CTO, no. There was someone who joined just before me. I've currently been with Settle for just over 6 months, let's say
so
6 to 8 months.
The last CTO left and you took over, like whilst you were there. So you didn't like, he didn't leave and then Dean joined. It was like Dean promoted CTO.
No. He was kind of leaving and he's actually a really cool guy, cool guy called Headley. He had some notice period to serve out and it was actually really helpful because he kind of did a bit of a handover and, you know, as is the world of startups, there's a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, especially if you're like a lot of developers, whoever you are, you know, people want to start their own thing and he's actually gone on to start his own thing, which is great. So really good.
Nice. Yeah. But yeah, so how are you running the team then? Like as a CTO, are you coding most of your time? Are you more like managing and making just sort of high level decisions? What sort of points settle that now?
So at the moment I spend probably 90% of my time really planning things, working in meetings. At the moment we don't currently have a product manager. So a lot of that falls to me. And you know, I'll be looking at the backlog, making sure everything's in order, planning the sprints ahead of time and looking at the roadmap. If there's sometimes we do a lot of spikes, so we look ahead of time into features before we actually start working on them and commit to them fully. So, you know, sometimes I do spikes, sometimes some other guys in the team do the spike. And Yeah, I mean, a little bit of my time I do spend coding. It's quite nice to stay sharp. I think I don't know realistically if that will scale given the size, you know, as we grow. But for now, yeah, it works out. So it's good.
Do you think you'll always be able to keep like 5-10% doing some coding, and then as you're offhand like product managing, you'll go into more higher level stuff? Or
I think it, you know, coming from the background I've come from, you know, the last companies I've worked at, there's almost, when you get big enough, there's almost no time at all to code. You know, you're spending most of your time, you know, in meetings and planning ahead and, you know, looking after the team. So, yeah, as we grow,
but you'll be happy to do that? Or
yeah, definitely. I've got to make way for these things. There's a lot, you know, the guys in the team, they're very lucky to work with some very talented people at Settleton. They know way more than I could ever know about coding. Yeah. So I just step back and let them do their thing sometimes.
Okay, that's cool. So I just assume that you kind of knew lots because you've written books about coding. I'm like, must be a genius.
No. I know lots about little things, not lots about lots.
But yeah, I first found out about you from you doing a progressive web app talk, which I found really interesting. So could you tell us a bit more about how you've been using those at Settled?
Yeah, definitely. I could kind of talk about that and then maybe dive a bit into our tech stack.
That helps. That'd be perfect.
Awesome. So at Settled, one of our biggest challenges is being able to cater for the needs of our users. And our users, I think at the moment we're about 65% of our users come to our sites via mobile device. Mm. You know, generally that's always 3G or 4G connections.
On Facebook ad or something and just click through? Or?
Exactly. People on the go, you know, they're quickly checking their phone to have a look at a property or a listing and they're going through the process. And one of the things that we really care about is performance on the website. So making sure that people can actually access what they need when they need it. Mm. And part of this, with this in mind, was why we went down the progressive web app route. So we have a part of our site that customers log into and they can manage their adverts and they can communicate with buyers and sellers. And we've built this as a progressive web app completely from the ground up. It's amazing. I mean, it's, you know, the functionality under the hood, we're using some service worker magic there. You've got our pages work offline. They load like, in the, you know, super blink fast. Of an eye. They're like instant almost. I'm trying to remember the exact stats, but I think we cut down almost 3 times on the amount of data that we were using compared to the original size.
Wow.
And I think we loaded up about 5 times faster. So the initial page load is 5 times
and
faster.
And do you have like any more features and stuff at the same time? Or
yeah, so there's loads more features in there. We're making heavy use of, you know, service worker caching and the abilities built into the browser. And, you know, the pages load offline. We're considering looking at push notifications soon.
Mm.
And, you know, I guess one of the other questions I always get asked is when, you know, oh, cool, you know, you're building a progressive web app.
Yeah.
What about Android? What about iOS? Because, you know, at the moment, progressive web apps, they support Android ecosystem and they work really well, you know, across, you know, Edge is busy building for it. Firefox already supports it. Safari supports it. So there's, not Safari. Everything but Safari, basically. Mm. And the thing about progressive web apps are they're almost like a set of best practices for your site and a way to build them that makes it faster. So even if, you know, Safari doesn't support it, you're still passing on benefits to your users. Going a bit deeper into our tech stack, we behind the scenes, we use some pretty cool stuff. We've got, we wrap everything up. So the progressive web app, the backend is actually built as a Node app.
Okay, cool.
And we are just serving it super light, you know, using Express. We're also wrapping that up as a Docker and as a Docker container and deploying that in EC2. So it means we really deploy. It's really easy to spin up a new environment and get things going. And then behind the scenes, we've got, you know, we've got a little bit of Mongo powering that. So it works quite well for us. It's quite rapid in terms of development.
That's, yeah, exactly the stack I learned at my bootcamp. So
yeah.
It's nice to hear because keep talking to people and they'll just say things. I'm like, oh, good. Yeah, Django. I don't know what's going on there. Which is the problem. But yeah, it sounds nice. So also you said here that you've been using CodeShip. Is that what?
Yeah. So, you know, thinking about the whole developer ecosystem from the time you write a line of code to the time you commit or, you know, push it to your repository, we have tests running. So we've built tests on top of that. And once the tests all run, well, actually, we use something called CodeShip. It's like a CI tool, so continuous integration, you know, kind of like Travis or Jenkins or that sort of tool out there. And what it actually does is it just, you know, just picks up the tests, runs our tests for us. It'll fail the build and give us a notification. And if it's happy, it will actually create the Docker container for us and deploy it. So it's really, well, put it on our Docker registry. So yeah, it's great.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds really, really good. It's best practices. Like, says initially putting in tests is sort of a bit of an ask, but in the long term, it's just, you know, you kind of need them, I think.
Definitely.
Which has been a problem for me as I'm learning. When you're like, oh, testing, I've got to write tests for my tests, but I don't even know how to test. And but when you get used to it, it's worth the investment. Yeah, so what would you say the biggest challenges you face besides the tech then is at all?
So, you know, being a small startup, I think one of the things that's quite tough is actually hiring. There is, you know, especially in London, there's so much demand for talent and being able to compete. You know, startups these days offer amazing packages. They're, you know, not just amazing packages, they have, you know, great offices, you know, competitive salaries. It's really hard to put yourself out there and be different, and also be able to find people that are kind of are there and believe in what you believe in. That's a whole new aspect. And it's tough as a startup to hire good talent and to find it. You know, it's, you end up paying quite a lot of money too for recruiter fees, you know.
Recruiters can be quite expensive.
We do a bit of a hybrid. We use a bit of recruiters. Preferably we try not to because, you know, it's expensive. But so far we've been quite lucky. A lot of the people that have come through in terms of dev have been from word of mouth or, you know, friends and that. So it's worked out good.
So you wrote a whole book about hiring. Is that been kind of useful at this point now, or was that from your other experiences with running other startups?
So yes, it, in a way it was kind of like the, in the past few jobs. So I managed to finish that book before I joined Settled, and the past few companies I worked for, I've almost taken a little bit from each of the way they run things, and they kind of build their hiring engine, if you will, and tried to think about how I would build the ultimate nirvana and the tips I've learned along the way. I like to think of it as just a collection of tips and things that companies are doing really well. And yeah, I think it's almost like a quick fire university. You know, you're almost like doing your own uni degree while writing a book, because there's research and, you know, there's a lot of work involved, and getting that book ready, I think definitely has helped. It helps you to think of, you know, when you're interviewing, thinking about the experience. It helps, you know, it's helped me think about how we put job descriptions out there, the whole thing, because people want to buy into your company. They don't want to just come to work.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, some people do, don't just want to come to work and sit down and do their job, but we're looking for people that
When you've got like the options, like if someone can make you differentiate between a different company and actually enjoy what you're doing, you're going to work so much better and want to stay there.
100%, yeah.
So what, on the subject of interviews, would be your favorite questions in an interview that really help you like understand the person? Or...
So I think there'd be two questions. One of the questions I think spans across regardless of role, and it spans quite well when it comes to startups. So one of the questions I always like to ask is, if I gave you £50 million right now, what would you build? And generally, most people are able to come up with an answer. Because, you know, they've have an idea or, you know, it might not necessarily be an app. Maybe it's like a startup that helps people do something. It could actually be a tangible thing instead of software. And generally, most people have an idea, and it kind of gives you a bit of an insight into their entrepreneurial brain. Like, what are they actually thinking? And then the next questions could be, you know, how would you monetize it? And there's loads of different offshoots that you can go to. So, and it gives an insight into what people are passionate about.
Like, the second question you always ask people.
It's a bit of a fun one. It's kind of towards the end of the conversation. And I like to ask people, you know, if you could choose, which would you rather be, a ninja or a pirate? And generally most people are like, they either laugh and they get it or, and it kind of gives you,
just don't know. I have no experience with these things. And you're like, bro, just answer the question.
It's a fun question. Exactly. So, what would you be?
My instant reaction was to say ninja, because I feel like, pirates more likely to be kind of raping people or doing bad things. But I've definitely done a lot more dressing up as a pirate than I've ever done as a ninja. So maybe like all the clothes would be quite bad and you get to like sail around the Caribbean and things. So in hindsight, perhaps pirate would be better.
Yeah.
But is it possible to blend the two? Like
a ninja pirate?
Yeah, a pirate that sometimes goes to Japan for a bit to do ninja stuff. And
yeah, that could work. Instead of having like a scimitar, you could have like a ninja sword. That could work. Yeah, I like it.
So have you got a specific one that you've always wanted to be?
Pirates, definitely a pirate.
Yeah?
Pirates, you know, steal all the gold, they drink lots of rum.
Yeah, I don't like sake.
You don't like sake? Exactly. Yeah. You're a pirate. You're a pirate.
Okay. Sorted. Okay, so now that you've interviewed people and chosen the right candidates, how do you then keep the team motivated to work hard and deliver but also enjoy themselves?
Yeah, so I think that's actually quite a tough question. You know, let's put money to the side for just for a second, you know, because it's also an important part of it. But I think people, A, when they have a vision that they're aligned to, you know, everyone believes they're going in the same direction. You know, why are we building the software? What difference is it going to make? That's a key part of it, keeping the vision communicated. On the more like day-to-day side of things, I try and regularly have one-to-ones with, you know, everyone that works for me, works with me, reports to me, just to find out, you know, sometimes we just go for a walk around the block. Sometimes we go grab a coffee and it's more like just finding out how they're doing, what they think about things. What are the little things that are bothering them? And, you know, generally we try and iron them out, or if there's ideas or changes they want to do, implementing those. I think if you didn't have that, it would almost be, you know, people would have ideas and or get upset about things, and there wouldn't be a reason to stay because no one's listening to what I have to say. And that's a big part for me. I think the only way I try and keep my ear to the ground is to have one-to-ones with everyone. There's actually a really cool, I don't know if you've ever read the book, The Hard Thing About Hard Things.
Nope. That sounds like a good book.
It's a great book. It's a great book. And it actually talks about, you know, the importance of one-to-ones and that. I recommend having a read. It's one of my top favorite books.
Thanks, man. I'll
have a read.
Do that. Yeah, definitely, like, from my experiences in startups, been like, you know, such a difference in the culture of ones where they do have one-to-ones a lot. Like, people just sort of feel listened to, as the ones where you haven't had them, you just sort of sit around and be like, well, what's the point of doing work if no one even knows why I'm doing it or what's going on? And
yeah,
it gets really very frustrating.
Yeah, I think, you know, another side of things, it's a tough, you know, I've been asked that question in an interview before. And without a doubt, I do think, you know, money does play a part in that. I think there's almost that whole Maslow's hierarchy of needs when you talk about, you know, do I have the air to breathe? Do I have the food to eat? And, you know, can I go home and afford my rent? That's, you know, that is a small part of it. But I think definitely knowing what you, why, the reason that you get up and come to work every day, what's the reason for that? And that's, you know, it's important.
Yeah. Like, I just left my job to go work on like some charity projects just because of I'm learning more and it's more fun. And
exactly. Like, work's supposed to be a bit of fun too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Can't be too serious.
Definitely. Can you describe some of the processes you have to like keep everyone like in the know of what's going on? Cause like one-to-ones are sort of very specific, but how do you just like broadcast, all right, everyone, we're doing this and this is why.
Yeah. So we have, every Friday we have this thing called beer stand-up. Oh, it's not necessarily beer because not everyone drinks beer, of course. Beer o'clock, you know, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. And being this size as a startup at the moment, there's 13 of us. So it's, you know, it's not the biggest office. It's quite nice. We kind of just stop. Everyone just chills out for a little bit. And we actually go around the room and, you know, talk about what each department is working on, you know, what features have been released, possibly if we're talking from a tech side, what features are still to come. And maybe you give a bit of a demo. We've got like this big screen in the office and we run through things. If there's, you know, we run through some financials and are we on track with our targets? So it's really like once a week, everyone knows exactly what's going on, which is great. It keeps everyone aligned and, you know, it's a good way to keep moving forward. We also have, in terms of tech and in terms of our roadmap, we have, it's open to everyone in the company. It's, you know, it's just an Excel doc, really. Google Doc, Excel spreadsheets, or whatever.
Yeah.
And it just contains a list of all the things we're working on and what's coming up. Of course, this shifts all the time, but it really gives people feel like they're in touch with what's going on instead of like this magic world of tech that's just doing stuff and we don't know what's going on. Yeah, so
it's always late and that's all you know. And you're like, it's a problem. Cool. So does that really help to keep, like, maintain like high output of people, or do you do anything else to keep people working hard? Or
I think, you know, going back to that question with what motivates you, when the people enjoy what they do and they come into work and they bought into the idea of, you know, what the vision is, it's not that hard to, you know, hard work almost comes naturally. People doesn't really feel like hard work because they're enjoying what they're doing. Of course, sometimes hard work is hard because you're working late or whatever, but we use, you know, just thinking about things. One of the big, again, I'm going to reference a book. Have you read The Lean Startup?
Yep.
That's, you know, absolutely great book. And it is such a core principle about what we do. We try and run everything as lean as possible. So, you know, if we're about to release a feature, we look at ways to say, you know, how can we release this in this sprint, for example? Sure, there's all these other things. And yes, we really want to do all these bells and whistles, but can we cut it right back and get this feature out there and get it tested? And often we will almost to the point of really finding a shortcut to get it out there, to test it first. we've been down paths sometimes where we've built something and it hasn't quite worked out, but that's okay because we've only spent, you know, half a sprint getting it out and ready as opposed to like three or four sprints building it. So it's a big part of keeping output high, really. Because when you feel like you're constantly releasing, it's almost like a snowball, and the snowball is rolling and rolling and rolling, and you know, it's cool. Definitely. It's great stuff.
So more long term, what's the big plans for the business?
So, you know, as our name implies, it sounds a bit cheesy, but we, you know, being settled is a big part of what we want to do. We want to really change the way that people buy and sell homes. You know, at the moment, you know, if you think back to the way that it typically a house is bought and sold, you know, you go to a high street estate agent, you know, they get a lot of money when they sell the house. You often, you know, they'll often do a lot of the viewings for you, which is great, but there's this sense of like, you know, you're almost distanced from the whole process. And, you know, once things start to go to the whole conveyancing process and solicitors, you know, you get sent letters in the post and there's almost no reason for that. Why can't that be digitized? Why can't that be online? And we want to take this whole process and move it online and make things easier and faster. You know, why shouldn't you be able to get a message on your phone from a buyer that's just visited your house and saying, here's some feedback on your house. This is what we love. This is what we didn't. The price is amazing, but you know, your garage could do with a paint. I don't know. You know, these sort of things. These are the big plans and the opportunities that that face us at the moment. I think Settled and a lot of other companies that are doing the same thing. You know, you've got the likes of Purple Bricks, eMove. There's a few other companies out there. They are. There's this time where there's like this mental shift to moving online, and it's an exciting time to be a part of this industry.
And you're going
to
stick with buying and selling, or are you also going to do like letting? Or
at the moment, you know, that isn't on the radar. But who knows? Who knows?
So, what about other markets like Europe and stuff? Or is it just like stick to UK for now?
Well, I can't give away too much, but, you know, there's definitely, we're obviously always keeping our eye on what's going on. And there is big plans. So, we're waiting to see what's going to happen.
It's the argument of like, do you just sort of grow in one place and just make it as good as possible, or try and grow as fast as possible and take as much of the market? Well, you can decide about that. And what other long-term goals have you got besides the business goal? You're already releasing a book over this summer.
So funny you mentioned Progressive Web Apps. I'm currently writing a book. It's going quite well. Almost finished.
Where do you fit this time in to write books?
I wake up really early in the morning.
Yeah, so that's not when you're gym, that's when you're writing.
Exactly, yeah. So I normally find time, sounds crazy, I wake up at like 5:30 in the morning and write for an hour and then get on the train, come in. But fortunately, writing books don't last forever. You know, it's a short burst of time where you really focus on things and get it out there. But so immediate long-term goals is get Progressive Web Apps book out. Come in this summer, which is the space. It's exciting.
Cool. What would you advise to give to someone who isn't technical about building a startup, like how to find the CTO or get like their MVP out there?
Yeah. So again, you know, going back to the whole Lean Startup book, I would almost beg, borrow and steal, and if possible, use what is out there already. You know, if you want to start your own online store, you know, use something like Shopify. It's amazing. There are a lot of solutions out there if you search for them that probably cover what you're trying to find. And not only that, before you even invest in something or test your or start building something, go and test your idea on real people. You know, I really like another. You know, I keep on banging on about books, but there's a book by one of the Google Ventures team called Design Sprints, and it's basically talks about this concept where you take a week out with important people in your organization or whoever, and you basically define how you're going to build this product. And by the end of day five, you've almost got like a sort of slideshow template of exactly what the product's going to be without having physically built it, and you can test it. You end up testing it on real people. Cool. So test it first. I mean, it's easy to start building, but you need to prove that it works first.
I'd agree with that. Certainly, there's a lot of coders that just like making things that they never test, and then
it's easy to build. It's not the case of build it and they will come.
For sure. Did you learn it the hard way by like building some things that you thought were really cool and then didn't go anywhere?
On the side, I've built. I started off a while ago building sort of like a developer news, you know, it was just a side project, a developer news website that kind of collated things, news from all over the place. And yeah, just a little bit of fun. Cool. And spent ages building it. No one ever visited it. And, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of reasons why on the other side of that. But yeah, I would definitely recommend that. And it's something I always try and, you know, I don't know if you get the same thing, but if anyone ever finds out that you're in computing or programming or whatever, they're like, oh, I really need this website built. Can you help me with it? And they have, you know, they have all these dreams and illusions of grandeur, but when it comes to the actual, will people visit your site or actually use it? That's another story.
Yeah, it's definitely a problem. As in, if someone comes with like a problem that like, okay, I'm literally about to learn this in a demo project anyway, then I may as well build it for someone anyway. But I've usually got enough ideas to not need to build it for someone else, and it's generally just a bit of an ass to ever do anything for other people. Okay, so you've also answered the next question of what are your favourite books, I think, but are there any others that you have missed off that you'd advise me or listeners to read?
What am I? I've just read a book at the moment that I thought was pretty cool, fiction? Actually. No, it's not fiction. I just read a book called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. I can't remember who it was by, but it's a really interesting book. It's not like you kind of think like this is like your management sort of style book, but it's actually written as a story and you follow along with it and you read about the different, like there's almost like a pyramid of the different five dysfunctions and each chapter goes through a different step in it. And it's, you know, it's quite interesting, especially when you work with teams all day long. It makes you stop and think like some of the actions or behaviors that I do, maybe I can change them.
So you probably could relate to like the mistakes that are going on and be like, oh crap.
Definitely.
That's cool. And then any fiction books that you just super recommend or do you not have time?
No, I read, fiction books. My favorite author, without a doubt, is called Bernard Cornwell. I don't know if you know
him. Yeah, I know him. I read most of the Sharps.
I've read most of the I've read all the Sharps, I think. And the series that I just absolutely plowed through was the one with the Vikings and the Saxons.
Yeah.
You know, we've got Uhtred, and they're running a show on TV at the moment. So,
that's
it's amazing. Nice. Yeah, he's a great writer.
A while ago, I read that. Oh, that's so good.
Great writer.
Nice. Well, I'll put links to those in the notes. In terms of other advice that's useful, what did you ever have mentors that gave you good advice, or did you ever just learn stuff from your parents or teachers?
I wouldn't say mentors as such. I think I've had a few bosses in the past.
Code mentors? Or?
No, I think I've had a few bosses in the past that have been quite quite encouraging and quite like, you know, helped along when I've needed help and gone to for advice. And I think one of the best pieces of advice I ever got from a boss was, we're still friends to this day, actually. He said, you know, make sure whatever you do, you keep on paying things forward. You know, when someone, so for example, if your boss helps you out and gives you a leg up, you know, make sure you're helping bring someone along the journey with you. Make sure you're always helping them out too. So it's not just like a take, take, take. It's a bit of a give in everything in life. And I think, you know, it sounds kind of cheesy, but I think the more you give out, the more things come back to you in life.
Yeah, I definitely think that. Like my friends that are like almost to the point of too generous, like initially like, wait, what are you doing? But then actually they get so much more back and you're like, actually, I should just be more like that and life will be fine. Cool. Yeah, that's a good piece of advice. And so who's your hero?
My hero? That's a tough question. Yeah. I was thinking long and hard about this. And I think for me, it'll probably have to be my dad. When I was a youngster, he passed away when I was about 15. But he was a cool guy. He was a cool guy. He, in some sort of weird way, I always like kind of remember, you always remember the good stuff and I always remember the good things he did. And I remember, you know, he was, you know, I had his own business and he, you know, liked to look after people. And I kind of try and bring a bit of those traits along with me. Who knows?
Yeah, it seems, seems like you're doing the right things. That's cool. So that was back in South Africa then.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So your house catches fire and everything that you own is within your house. After saving like loved ones and pets, what would be the thing, the one item that you would take with you?
Normally, I would probably say, you know, I'd grab
Mac.
The MacBook, right? But, you know, I'd like to think it's all safely stored in the cloud.
Yeah.
And insurance would pay out on that. So I'd probably say I would sprint and get the triathlon bike.
Yeah.
I have this, it's not, you know, it's not like that amazing, but I've got the sexy triathlon bike. It's all carbon fiber.
Nice.
You know.
Is that partly because it's the most expensive thing you own? Or
yeah, probably.
Like attached to it?
No, probably.
Hold at the seat and then...
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's, I call her Juliet.
Yeah?
Yeah, she's beautiful.
I forgot her name. So it's like another pet, really.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if I told my wife that, but you know.
Yeah. Sweet.
It's going to sound random. Mm-hmm. Again, sounds like I'm an exercise freak when we talk. I would say a foam roller.
Yeah?
I used to, like, you know, when I was growing up, I was a bit like, it's all the stretching malarkey about, you know, people stretching after they go for a run.
It takes time and doesn't help anything.
No, it does. That's what I used to think. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I was having a bit of trouble with my knee and a friend said, get a foam roller. And I was like, okay, I'll try anything at this stage. And I got started with a foam roller and it was really sore when I first started. The pain is like a different pain that I've never experienced, but it really helps. It's amazing. I would recommend it. Especially, you know, being in a computer all day long is not easy.
Sweet. Cool. Took up like Jaeger after I started breakdancing. It helped loads with my stretching. And I'd recommend stretching.
Yeah.
I didn't used to bother it. Given the choice of anyone in the world, who would you want as a dinner party guest?
Controversial, perhaps. But I'd have to say Jesus.
The Jesus.
The Jesus, yeah.
Okay, cool. What would you ask him? Why Jesus?
I have no idea what I'd ask him. I'd probably talk to him about... You know, imagine finding out about everything that went on during that time, you know, like, you know, things that he was going through, you know, I mean, you know, talking about the crucifixion, all that sort of stuff. Well, imagine being able to talk about that sort of stuff. That'd be pretty amazing.
That would be pretty interesting. Is it like being stabbed in the side?
Exactly. I know, right? And, you know, not all that, like all the other things that went on. I think, you know, when you think about the Bible, it covers some things, but there's like whole reams of stories that it didn't cover. And it'd be great to find out all
about
those. What
did you do in between 20 and 30? I mean, all this time.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
Nice. Okay, cool. What would happen if you couldn't speak English? You'd just be like, oh, Jesus.
Well, I'm sure he could, though. I'm sure he could.
Okay, nice. As a wrap-up, where can I find out more about you, follow you, these kind of things?
So I have my own blog. If you're into, you know, finding out more about progressive web apps or anything kind of tech related that I find that's out there, I try and regularly blog about articles. My blog is at deanhume.com. I'm also on Twitter, and my Twitter handle there is just Dino Hume, and there is lots of whatever I find. It'll sometimes be memes. It'll sometimes be funny puns, or it might actually be serious work stuff. So, yeah, that's it.
Nice. Thanks, man. Yeah, I'll put links to that in the notes and write a summary of everything. And
sweet. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been great.
I hope you enjoyed that insightful session. So I'd like to wrap up with my key take-homes that I learned from each guest. Writing a book is a great way to focus and really understand a topic. It doesn't last forever and can really help build your credibility. 2. Pay it forward. Don't expect anything for free, just approach things sensibly, expecting them to cost you time or money. Be nice and genuine to everyone you meet without expecting anything back. Anything you do get back, you can be extra grateful for. 3. In the long term, a CTO isn't going to be a coder and needs to have the skills as a manager if he wants to retain that title. When hiring for a CTO in a startup, it's important to think that this person can be a manager in the long term. Or if you do have a technical background, make sure to think about how you could grow your mindset as a person to take on the new challenges of hiring and managing a team, rather than just being a coder. Dean suggests a lot of great books in this episode. If you want to find out more about them, I'm trying to write an in-depth review and summary of every good book I read on my website and blog. In the show notes, you'll find relevant links to find out more, buy them, or get a free Audible trial to listen to them. Okay, so his recommendations. 1. The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. It's a tale of starting and growing a business to $1 billion, and then losing it all, getting it back, and then nearly losing it again, and then in the process starting another $1 billion business. It basically outlines that there is no recipe for success, and it is defined by what you do when things are going wrong. It's a really good read. 2. The Lean Startup by Eric Ries. The book that started the whole lean movement. It's a standard for all cash-strapped entrepreneurs. 3. Design Sprints by Google Ventures. Basically, the steps to design a full idea of your business model. And, which is pretty handy. 4. The Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Leconcini. This is an interesting fictional story used to highlight the main issues that causes teams to become ineffective. Conversations in the book really show how to remedy a bad situation and to get buy-in from others. And then lastly, on the fiction side, Bernard Cornwell. He's a fantastic fictional writer who focuses on historical-themed novels across the globe. Whenever I'm travelling, I love to read a Bernard Cornwell book, if he's written one in that country. He has amazing imagery and storytelling. It really gets you into the mindset of the character, and they're always a great read. As always, thanks a lot for listening. If you found the podcast useful, please support me by rating the podcast in iTunes or your preferred app. Please become a subscriber and share your favourite podcast with others, as it really helps me grow the podcast. I'm Sam, and this has been another episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. I hope you enjoy your day.